Hi, Marco Werman here. Before we get to the show, time is running out to make your gift before our fundraiser ends on December 31st. If you've already donated to our nonprofit newsroom this year, thank you. You make it possible for us to do this very important work, to bring human-centered coverage from all around the globe to your ears every single weekday, to bring you stories straight from lived experience from the people who are impacted the most, and to broaden your horizons and keep you connected to the world beyond our borders. If you have not given yet, this is your chance. By making a gift, you're not only helping our newsroom flourish, you're also paying it forward for your fellow listeners who are not in a position to donate right now. Please make your gift today to sustain our nonprofit newsroom. You can head to theworld.org/give to donate and learn more. That's theworld.org/give. Now, the show. It's been 2 weeks since a typhoon pummeled the Philippines, but it feels like it just hit yesterday. In places where emergency responders have yet to arrive, power is still out.
Much of the cities are still dark at night, and many people haven't been able to reach their loved ones to even say, hey, I'm here.
I'm Marco Werman. Also, in parts of Syria ravaged by war, people have to choose between fighting COVID or hunger.
A resident in one of the camps who told us, you know, I've never brought a mask. I can barely buy bread. When I have a choice, I always go for bread.
And an archaeologist tells us what it's like discovering tools used by Neanderthals right next to mammoth bones.
You know, it is a thrill every time to find something and to wonder who was the last person who touched this. That never goes away.
A digger's delight. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Thank you for being with us today. We start in Hong Kong, where a major independent media outlet, Stan News, was shut down today. Police raided its office and arrested senior staff. This is the latest in a crackdown on the media in Hong Kong, which returned to Chinese rule in 1997, but with the One Nation, Two Systems guiding policy. And yet concerns about press freedom have persisted ever since. To talk more about this, we're joined by Tom Grundy. He's the editor-in-chief of the Hong Kong Free Press, an independent media organization based in Hong Kong. That's where he joins us from. Tom, can you tell us what happened exactly with Stand News today in Hong Kong?
Well, six figures linked to Stand News were arrested in the early hours. 200 national security officers raided the offices in scenes that resembled the raid on the Apple Daily offices earlier in the year. Footage showed police taking dozens of boxes out of the newsroom. The acting chief editor, Patrick Lam, was among those arrested. He immediately stepped down. You also have Ronson Chan, who was detained but not arrested. He's also the head of the Hong Kong Journalists Association. Now, this is a not-for-profit online news outlet. It has a pro-democracy slant, but it's very widely read and respected. As the day went on today, we heard from the National Security Police, but by about 4 p.m., they had shut down completely, and by 11 p.m. local time, not long ago, their entire website had been replaced with a closure message.
And so was this an expected move by the authorities? Did the staff members of Stan News see this coming?
Well, I guess there is somewhat of a process that we have seen whereby you see some attention or saber rattling within the state-run press. Eventually, you will see officials or the local police take an interest and make remarks about certain civil society groups or entities. I mean, since the onset of the national security law, over 50 groups have disbanded under pressure. And one might say that Stan News may have seen it coming in that just after the Apple Daily raid, they removed all opinion pieces from their website. It also halted donations, and six of the eight board members, some of which were arrested today, stepped down. The timing of this also comes just a day after Apple Daily in court were also hit with this colonial era charge under which people were arrested today of conspiring to publish seditious publications. This law, of course, predates the security law, but it is being enforced by the National Security Police. This comes just a few weeks after Chief Secretary John Lee accused the news outlet of being biased over some of its reporting on local smart prisons.
And that message officials posted on the door of Stan News today, office closed, does that imply they are shuttered permanently?
Well, already Stan News itself has taken the prerogative to shut itself down, perhaps because some of its leadership now will be seeking bail, or perhaps they want to remove things as things are being investigated. But as of 11 p.m., all of its content and its social media feeds have been removed entirely. This was similar moves and playbook as to what happened with Apple Daily. Steve Lee, the senior superintendent of the National Security Police, sort of evaded questions as to whether this was what the authorities desired. They just went on to say that its funds have now been frozen. It wants to investigate what its UK arm is intended for. They said that they have concealed monetary transfers and basically appealed to anybody with links to Stan News to sever them.
So very clearly, media people in Hong Kong are under threat. I mean, it seems one by one, independent media are getting choked off by Beijing. What kind of an effect has this had on the already shrinking free media landscape in Hong Kong?
Yeah, of course, we've already seen Apple Daily shut down and its leadership arrested. RTHK, the local equivalent of NPR or the BBC, has come under pressure and has been accused of basically becoming state media by some quarters. Today shows that this crackdown on press freedom, despite this All Patriots election that has seen basically a legislature returned with just pro-Beijing and pro-establishment lawmakers, you know, this crackdown is seemingly going to continue regardless into the new year. And police have shown that they have a willingness to use colonial era sedition laws as well as the national security law to tighten the screws.
So you're expecting more of this going into the new year? I mean, is this just how it's going to be going forward in Hong Kong?
It's very difficult as to know, you know, when things may end. In this sense, we don't know whether we're looking at a Hong Kong that may resemble more like the mainland or something like Singapore, where there is quite tight restrictions and a fake news law. But certainly we've seen over 100 arrests in light of the national security law, over 50 groups disbanded. The government has said that this has all brought stability after the 2019 unrest, but obviously a lot of concerns from the media industry now and a lot of criticism from the local press club, from Reporters Without Borders and from the Constituent Journalist tonight as another news outlet disbands in Hong Kong.
Tom Grundy is the editor-in-chief of the Hong Kong Free Press, an independent media organization based in Hong Kong. Tom, thank you very much for your time today.
Thanks for having me.
In addition to the journalists from Stan News who were detained, someone else was taken in today in Hong Kong. Canto pop star Denise Ho. Her popularity, especially in the Chinese diaspora, is thanks to ballads like this. In Hong Kong, she's been part of the pro-democracy movement for years, publicly criticizing the central government in Beijing. Denise Ho has even taken her activism to the UN Human Rights Council.
The Vienna Declaration guarantees democracy and human rights. Yet in Hong Kong today, these are under serious attack.
That was 2019. I asked a guest we just spoke with, Tom Grundy, how Denise Ho fits within the other arrests today. She'd been on the board of directors of Stan News, he explained, and like others with the organization, she tried to distance her association. She stepped down from the board. When police were asked why then go after her, Grundy said this was the response from Steve Lee, Hong Kong's national security chief.
Steve Lee said that, you know, such people will be pursued for the rest of their lives.
When I spoke with superstar Denise Ho in 2019, I put this to her.
Does celebrity status give you a level of safety? Like, are you concerned for your own safety right now?
I have a lot of friends who are concerned for my safety after my speech in the UN. But personally, I do believe, you know, what you said just now is right. My celebrity might be somewhat of a protection for me right now.
Not protection enough, apparently. Today was not the first time Denise Ho was arrested. And after banning her music in China, Beijing seems determined to keep Denise Ho quiet. In March of 2020, though, just as COVID was stopping the planet in its tracks, Denise Ho gave a TED Talk and concluded it with a song she wrote about people climbing a mountain to see the first glimpse of light after the darkness of a cold night. She dedicated it to freedom fighters in Hong Kong and around the world. The Philippines have been hit with 15 typhoons this year. Typhoon Rai, which hammered the island nation on December 16th, was by far the worst. Many have compared it to Typhoon Haiyan in 2013, which killed more than 6,000 Filipinos. This time the death toll is in the hundreds, not thousands.
But the destruction from Rai is massive, and the recovery has been difficult. Rai blew through an area the size of South Carolina with winds of up to 160 miles per hour. It made landfall 9 times, striking island after island. Brenda Barton is the World Food Program's country director for the Philippines. She's toured some of the worst-hit areas and joins us from Manila. When did you actually get to survey the damage, Brenda? And if you could, give us your impressions of what you saw.
Well, as soon as I could get in, I flew in just the day before Christmas Eve, and I came out that Christmas Eve evening, and it was really something in my 30-year career of WFP like I have never seen before. I felt like I walked into a place that had been carpet bombed. I went into a city called Surigao City. It's one of the big cities next to two smaller islands in the northern part of Mindanao. And I tell you, it looked like it was a combination between a typhoon and a giant tornado that had just ripped through the whole area.
Can you just tell us maybe about one person you met as you surveyed the damage? Like, what did they want you to know?
You know, it was heartbreaking because it was, you know, I met people on Christmas Eve day. And this is a day when Filipinos are used to coming together with family. They're looking forward to going to midnight mass. And all these families could think about was just, what am I going to do to build my house? I talked to a couple of little girls and, you know, I asked them, I said, you know, what is your Christmas wish? One of them was just so moved, she couldn't even tell me. She ran away. The other one said, I just want to have my house back. And they pointed to their house that was off in a field that had just been torn to bits. Other people were just desperate for food, desperate for water, desperate for help.
How is it that so few people perished in Typhoon Rai?
One of the really great things is that people listened to the government and they learned the lesson from Haiyan that had killed 6,000 people in 2013. So what did people do? They went into evacuation centers when they were told. They left their houses that they're so afraid to leave because they're afraid of looting. They're afraid that they'll be blown away, but they did it.
Extraordinary. It's been 2 weeks now since the typhoon struck. What are conditions like for people today?
I talked to my team today who were on the ground and who also managed to get off to two smaller islands off Surigao City. And it really, again, was just so concerning. People are starting to beg by the roadside. They're gathering near the major roads. The electricity and telecoms, they're very, very sporadic. Much of the cities are still dark at night. And many people haven't been able to reach their loved ones to even say, hey, I'm here. I'm okay. We're starting to see issues of fuel prices rising because there isn't electricity. Therefore, people have to use generators. Issues of sanitation and diarrhea because people are living in very, very close confines. In fact, today we were really concerned because there was a major storm that again broke through the area, lots of rain, and it forced people to flee into evacuation centers and again live in close confines, often, you know, again risking against COVID, which is another calamity that has hit this area.
I know that you're just trying to manage a crisis right now, but the cost of rebuilding must be on everyone's minds in the Philippines and these places that got hit. Are there enough local resources to bring these parts of the country back? Or have you been seeing places that you worry may never rebuild?
You know, we just from the experience of Haiyan, it took a good year for the resources to be available. The government obviously is going to do what it can, but they have been very much, you know, hit by the economic crisis themselves in terms of responding to COVID. And just in the area, one of the areas, again, that I visited, already before this typhoon, there had been economic contraction for the first time since 1995 of, you know, industries such as coconut that they rely on for exports, industries such as fisheries. So already there was a contraction in the country, not just, you know, there, but nationwide. And we know that already, again, in the area I visited, 53% of the people could not afford a nutritious diet. So imagine getting this crisis on top of a crisis. It really does bring everybody into a very, very difficult situation, including a government like the Philippines.
Brenda Barton, the World Food Program's country director for the Philippines, updating us on the emergency response following Typhoon Rai, which devastated large areas in the islands. Brenda, thank you very much for the update.
Thank you very much.
Coming up, archaeologists describe a trove of mammoth bones and tools found near London as mind-blowing.
They still fit perfectly in the hand. It's incredible. You know, when they came out of the soil, you could hold them and you could see exactly how they would have been used.
But what did Neanderthals do with those tools?
Yeah, so right there is the money question, really, for the whole project.
The story of that Ice Age research is just ahead. You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. The Nile is massive, but still does not provide enough water for Egypt. To try and conserve more water, the country's strongman president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, has a new decree, no more decorative plants. Jasmine fields, gardens, houseplants, all get the axe. With a dwindling water supply, Sisi said it was time for the country to focus instead on crops that he called useful. El-Fati El-Tahir is a professor of environmental and civil engineering at MIT and studies water use in Egypt. El-Fati, what do you think of Sisi's plan to ban decorative plants? Is that going to help Egypt live within its means when it comes to water?
It's an interesting decision. I think it sends a signal that there is a water crisis in Egypt, and it also sends the message that the government is trying hard to address it.
One would hope that a decree like this would be made with some research and study. I mean, do you have an idea of how much water could be saved without watering the nice plants at home and how much it will actually offset the other immediate needs for water?
Where water is consumed in Egypt is mostly in agriculture. And I have to say that the government in Egypt has been trying very hard to address the water issue. Better water management through the construction of Hayes 1 Dam, they improved productivity of agriculture is very high. The yield of different crops is very high. They also have a serious effort in controlling population growth in Egypt. So, and they have been also reusing a lot of the water. So there are serious efforts by the government, but the problem is immense and the challenge is huge. We just published a paper in Nature Communications a couple of months ago. We think that the current pricing structure of water in Egypt is not satisfactory.
When you talk about water pricing, is it too cheap in Egypt right now?
Yeah, it's actually very cheap. You almost pay nothing, which is quite surprising.
I was going to say that should be the opposite.
Exactly.
When was it that Egypt started taking more water than the Nile could supply?
In the 1960s. There was plenty of water in Egypt. And since then, population growth, which has been significant, Egypt now population approaches and exceeds 100 million people. But also, interestingly, with economic growth. And economic growth, basically, people started eating more meat and meat products. And so the consumption of water per person increased. And so that's what creating this crunch.
How quickly would, say, your recommendations need to be implemented to avoid a crisis?
I mean, I think very soon. What we concluded in that paper is that within the next few years, like 2-3 years, we are not saying about next decade. We are not saying by the end of the century. We are saying next few years.
I got to ask you this. I mean, oftentimes a decree like this will be made, but the elites of a country are spared. Do you really believe like an Egyptian government minister with a nice lawn in front of their house that the ruling will be enforced for them?
I don't know. This gets into the realm of politics. I'm just a hydrologist who studies water.
So El-Fati, how confident do you feel about Egypt's water future, or are you nervous?
It's one of those problems where action is needed and needed now. But also, I think there are lessons for other parts of the world. We live in a world where many people behave as if we have unlimited resources. That's not true. We have limited resources. We have to define them and learn to live within our means.
El-Fati El-Tahir is a professor of environment and civil engineering at MIT, where he focuses on water use in Egypt. El-Fati, thank you very much.
Oh, thank you very much.
In a stone quarry just 2 hours from London, archaeologists found one of the biggest Ice Age discoveries in recent years, a mammoth graveyard, literally, full of bones of the extinct mammoth, the precursor to the modern elephant. And not just mammoth bones, they also found tools likely used by Neanderthals. The findings are the focus of a new BBC documentary, Attenborough and the Mammoth Graveyard. Lisa Westcott-Wilkins is an archaeologist with Dig Ventures, the team that led the excavation. So how many mammoths did you actually find at the site, Lisa?
Well, we haven't actually found any complete mammoths, but what we did find is the remains of at least 5. And there, I mean, we have really just scratched the surface, so we know there's going to be loads more there.
I mean, the documentary suggests it's just like everywhere you kind of like turn up the dirt, there's a mammoth bone. Everyone, it seems, who's been involved in this dig has had their minds blown. Have you ever been part of a dig quite like this one?
Well, no, and I certainly never expected to. So it's been mind-blowing from like the first moment. This material is quite a lot older than anything I expected to encounter in my career as an archaeologist. It's been an incredible learning experience, believe me.
There were also Neanderthal tools found at the site. What were those tools, and is it possible to know whether the tools were used expressly for the purpose of hunting or butchering the mammoths at the time?
Yeah, so right there is the money question, really, for the whole project. The first tool that was found is a hand axe, sometimes also referred to as a biface. We don't really know exactly what the bifaces were used for. I mean, they're called a hand axe, but of course, we've not found one grasped in a Neanderthal skeleton hand, so we don't know exactly how they used them. The other tools that we found were smaller, and they're called scrapers, which, you know, we know from other contexts that they were used for separating meat from the hide, for example, doing a kind of scraping motion. And they're very, very effective. They still fit perfectly in the hand. It's incredible. You know, when they came out of the soil, you could hold them and you could see exactly how they would have been used. They were found in very, very close proximity to the long bones that came out on our last season. By close, I mean 20 to 30 centimeters max. So I think it's a really, really good assumption for us to say, look, they were being used on these bones. You know, this is a population of mammoths that were being harvested in some way by the Neanderthals. Sitting on that ancient riverbed and knowing that they were in that very marshy side, very silty, very claggy side of the river, you know, it's very evocative.
Must be a pretty distracting thought, though, when you're in the middle of a dig. Are you constantly kind of closing your eyes and imagining what the world might have looked like back then?
Not constantly, but literally every time. You know, it is.
You got to work after all, right? You got to.
Yeah, exactly. And it is a science question. You know, it's always a science question to unravel the site and to dig it in the right way and to take the right samples. But you can't help but wonder about it, especially in a site of this great antiquity. It was kind of cognitive dissonance standing in the bottom of the site with cars whizzing not too far away and not realizing, you know, 5 meters below their car was a scene like this. And, you know, separated by time, but, you know, ever so close. And that's how it feels every time. You know, you're so close to understanding something, to touching something that has so much meaning.
Well, I think of the amateur fossil hunter who actually found this site in the first place, and she's holding this old axe head and sits there in wonder. And the last person perhaps who held it was a Neanderthal. When you hold that, what does it feel like?
She describes it very well. It is absolutely spine tingling. But yeah, it is mind-boggling. It's like that with anything you find, whether it was left behind yesterday. I mean, the science of archaeology could help me excavate your desk. I can learn things using archaeological techniques from things that people lost yesterday. You know, it is a thrill every time to find something and to wonder who was the last person who touched this. That never goes away.
Lisa Westcott-Wilkins is an archaeologist with Dig Ventures. Her team's excavation is featured in the new BBC documentary, Attenborough and the Mammoth Graveyard, which premieres tomorrow. Lisa, thank you so much for your time.
It's a pleasure.
We'll be right back. You're listening to The World. When a famous food blogger gave up eating meat, she had to adjust to a new vegan identity and hang on to her Korean culture.
Who am I if I don't get to eat these things that I associate so much with my Korean-ness?
We meet the Korean vegan. And U.S. elections aside, we look at how Russian disinformation impacts people in Russia, on the world. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX. COVID-19 has been with us for a little more than 2 years now. That's when the virus was first detected in Wuhan, China. In a year-end news conference today, officials at the World Health Organization took a look back at the pandemic. Tedros Ghebreyesus, the director general of the WHO, said a lot has been achieved, including sharing the COVID-19 genome. Also,
the development of new vaccines proved so effective at cutting serious disease and death. They represent a scientific masterclass.
Ghebreyesus conceded, though, that the global response has not always been swift.
Populism, narrow nationalism, and hoarding of health tools, including masks, therapeutics, diagnostics, and vaccines, by a small number of countries undermined equity and created the ideal conditions for the emergence of new variants.
Delta and Omicron led to spikes in hospitalizations and deaths. But Ghebreyesus said he remains optimistic. 2022 could see the end of what he called the acute stage of the pandemic. And he emphasized the WHO's goal of reaching a global vaccination rate of 70% by the middle of next year.
We have 185 days to the finish line of achieving 70% by the start of July 2022. And the clock starts now.
Even for countries with advanced healthcare systems, tackling the coronavirus pandemic is challenging. Of course, it's a lot harder in a place ravaged by civil war, displacement, and with a government willing to punish its own people. That's the situation in Idlib province in the northwest corner of Syria, where health workers are bracing for whatever COVID-19 brings next. The world's Shirin Jafari reports.
The Idlib Community Treatment Center is quiet these days. In this video, shared with me by a healthcare worker, a man in a yellow protective gown and face mask writes down the details of a patient. He's a middle-aged man, looking gaunt and exhausted. It's not clear if the Omicron variant has made its way here yet, but this part of Syria is still coming out of a deadly third wave of the coronavirus.
It was difficult days. It was the most serious wave in South Syria, Delta variant.
Dr. Mustafa Al-Aidu used to head the health directorate in Idlib province. He now works as a program manager for a medical NGO called MedGlobal. Aidu himself got sick with COVID-19, and so did his family.
We survived, alhamdulillah.
We survived, he says, thank God, but a lot of people did not. The official death toll from COVID-19 in Syria is about 3,000, according to the World Health Organization. But the real number could be much higher. Idlib is the last remaining area under opposition control, but fighting is not over. Wasim Bakir is a health official in the city of Ariha. When I reached him earlier this week, he said there were bombings on that same day.
There were bombing some of camps around Mart Musrin city. And you know that there are a lot of challenges for people, especially in winter.
Bakir says international NGOs helped set up three isolation centers in this area, one near the displacement camps.
There were a lot of people that was admitted in our isolation center, and there were a lot of people that died from COVID-19.
At least 2 million people in that part of Syria have been displaced. Most live in camps where contagious diseases like COVID can spread quickly. That's according to Claire Sanflippo, head of mission for Syria at the NGO Médecins Sans Frontières. She says many displaced people simply cannot afford protective gear like masks.
We talked to a resident in one of the camps who told us, I can barely buy bread. When I have a choice, I always go for bread.
Sanflippo says NGOs like MSF are providing protective gear to medical workers, running treatment centers and medical clinics. But when it comes to vaccinations, Syria is not doing well. Less than 5% of the population is fully vaccinated. That's one of the lowest rates in the world. Syria has received AstraZeneca and Chinese vaccines through COVAX, the global system set up to provide vaccines for lower-income countries. But Sanflippo of MSF says people are hesitant.
People have limited public trust in the public healthcare system. There's also some lack of knowledge regarding COVID, but a lot of the reasons actually seem to be linked to the vaccine itself.
Some Syrians are suspicious about foreign-made vaccines, she says, and that includes medical workers. This is what Dr. Hala Al-Ghawi saw, too, when she and her team conducted a study about vaccine hesitancy in northwestern Syria.
Actually, the most difficult one are doctors and medical staff.
They can influence patients' decision to get the vaccine or not, she says. Doctors told her they wanted to see more data. Dr. Ghawi says health professionals are trying to counter misinformation about vaccines, and they're also trying mandates.
Some organization for their medical staff, they obligate them to have vaccine, and if they not committed, they will not be continue their work at hospital.
A big geopolitical decision is looming for people in northwest Syria. Right now, there is only one official border crossing that NGOs can use to get supplies to the province, and that's the one with Turkey. In a few days, the United Nations Security Council is expected to hold a vote to decide whether to keep the crossing open. Zaher Sahlul is a Syrian physician with MedGlobal. He says closing that border would be catastrophic.
This area, which is under the control of the opposition, is disconnected from the rest of Syria. So the only way to reach them is through Turkey. That means children will have malnutrition. Women who are pregnant won't get prenatal care. Patients with COVID won't get treatment or oxygen or vaccination.
Sahlul says he hopes that the Biden administration will make it a priority to keep that border crossing into northwest Syria open. For The World, I'm Shirin Jafari.
In the last few years, we've heard a lot of news about Russian disinformation campaigns, but the Kremlin also uses state media to spread disinformation at home about political opposition in Russia and about marginalized groups. The podcast On Spec has been examining disinformation campaigns around the world and what happens when people in the same country get very different information from different sources. Today, journalist Theo Mertz from On Spec tries to answer a question he frequently got when he lived in Moscow. What is it like to be gay in Russia? And a note here, some of the people he speaks with wanted to use only their first name because of the stigma around discussing LGBTQ communities.
I should be able to tell you what it's like to be gay in Russia, because I am gay and I am in Russia. But the fact is that I can't, and I never really know what to say when people ask me this. I think that's because there are two Russias. There's the Russia of my professional life, the country that I see as a journalist. It's a place where the LGBT community is attacked by vigilante groups, and gay people have to flee abroad because of concerns about their safety. It's a country where police arrest gay rights activists in the streets if they dare to protest.
Russian police detained as many as 30 gay rights activists who took part in an unsanctioned rally in St. Petersburg.
And then there's the Russia of my personal life. That's a place not often seen in Western news reports. In this world, my queer friends live openly. They go out to bars, go to work, fall in love, fall out of love. They get their news from progressive online media and avoid Russian state television. The big difference from the West is that gay life here is set against the backdrop of constant state-sponsored homophobia. That means doors to gay clubs are unmarked, and you won't see any rainbow flags on the streets outside. This spars down a set of stairs in a basement, and there's no signage from the outside. But it's far from the only place like it in Moscow. I'm not just talking about clubs, but also gay community spaces, LGBT film festivals, and sexual health services that cater to gay people. To understand how these two Russias think, you have to look at the kind of media they're consuming.
Как то? Президент? Вы же сами за него голосовали?
Да ни за кого я не голосовал. До свидания, дядя.
This is a video that was released just before Russia's last presidential election in 2018. It's in support of Vladimir Putin, and from a Western perspective, it's odd to say the least. There's a slightly pudgy, middle-aged man who says he's not planning on voting. Then he goes to sleep and wakes up in a nightmare future where Putin's no longer the president. He walks into the kitchen and sees this young guy sitting at the breakfast table, buffing his nails with a little rainbow-coloured file. "I'm the gay you've taken in for adoption," the guy says. Then he throws his nail file down in a sulk. The man's wife looks at her husband and she says, "What's wrong with you? It's the law now in Russia that every family has to take in a gay for adoption. We've still got a week left. If he doesn't find a boyfriend, then you'll have to be in a relationship with him." The middle-aged man's looking around in horror and confusion. "The law's the law," the gay guy says. Then he bites down suggestively on a banana. The video seems like a sitcom, and I have to admit that I laughed when I first saw it. But the message is serious and it's clear. We are protecting you from the gays who pose a threat to our conservative, moral way of life. We are protecting you from the progressive West, where anything goes and where they support LGBT rights. Vote for us.
This is their way of fighting. It's an ugly way of fighting, but it's what they do.
This is Polina. She's 22 years old and a university student. She's conservative and a supporter of President Vladimir Putin, and she says she supports the way Russian state media talk about gay people.
They should be kinder, but there has to be some opposition. I don't want my child to grow up being told that being gay is the norm.
Polina's obviously intelligent and well-read. When we met, she'd even brought along an iPad so she could quote from articles she'd seen about the LGBT community. Like a lot of people I've spoken to in the country, Polina says she's not homophobic, but she has views that certainly would be considered homophobic in the West. These views have been shaped by state media. When the nightly broadcast comes on Russia's Channel 1, you can hear some offensive and sometimes just bizarre things about LGBT people.
Екатерина Лахова приравняла радугу к свастике. Ей не угодило мороженое с таким названием, якобы.
This is a news report about a rainbow-coloured ice cream that some suggested was out to change the sexual orientation of consumers. After Putin himself got involved, the ice cream makers even had to come out and defend themselves, saying they just like rainbows. But much more than the straight-up fake news about what's going on inside Russia, there's a constant drip of distorted news about LGBT rights in the West. Recently, drag queens in New York did story times for children at a few public libraries. In Russia, the story was blown up into a big controversy about how the powerful gay lobby is brainwashing American kids, and Russian kids might be next. Polina said she thought this propaganda from the West was shaping the global conversation about LGBT people. She even used that word, propaganda. This atmosphere takes its toll on people. Pyotr is a 33-year-old psychotherapist in Moscow. He's liberal, he doesn't support Putin, and he gets his news from progressive online outlets. Pyotr told me about his coming out to his mum.
Many years ago, when I first told her I was gay, the first question she asked me was, "What will the neighbors say?" It's clear that behind this, there was fear on my behalf and what was going to happen. Was I really the same monster that they talk about in the media?
It's not just the way gay people are portrayed in the media. There are also real hate crimes and attacks on the community. The most extreme example is the gay purges in the Autonomous Republic of Chechnya, in which gay men were rounded up by security services, tortured, killed, or forced to leave the country.
Put bag on my head, and that guy, he said that it's my last seconds.
Accusations of torture.
There's been anti-gay legislation as well, like the 2013 gay propaganda law, which makes it illegal to promote, quote, non-traditional sexual relationships to minors. This gay propaganda law effectively outlaws any type of LGBT campaigning in Russia, and it means that nobody can hold pride marches or mention homosexuality in schools. A lot of queer Russians have decided to emigrate because of this law. Pyotr said he'd talked to some friends who'd left, and it helped him understand his own experiences as a gay man in Russia better.
They told me this interesting thing. They went abroad, and then after 6 months, they had noticed something was missing. And eventually, they realized there was no anxiety, constant anxiety. When you live in Russia and you walk around Moscow, you get used to this feeling of anxiety. You're always thinking, am I dressed right? Can people see something about me? You pass people who are laughing, and you're always thinking, maybe they are laughing at you. You emigrate, and half a year later, you don't feel that anymore. It is as if you can breathe easier, like your lungs have opened up.
Even though life might be easier abroad, Pyotr himself doesn't have any plans to leave his friends and family. And there are a lot of queer activists who are staying to change things in Russia. Some of them are setting up their own media companies to combat the disinformation.
Hi.
Hi, Sasha. Are you okay to talk now?
Among them is Sasha Kazantseva, the founder of Ozine, a popular online journal that celebrates LGBTQ life. When I spoke to Sasha, she pointed out that more and more people are getting their news from online sources rather than state-controlled TV, meaning they have access to different kinds of ideas.
I have a positive view here because, you know, now a lot of young people, a lot of young queer people, they see how it works in other countries. They, due to the internet, they can see that there are other countries where queer people's rights are respected. And they have another perspective.
These two Russias aren't going to resolve their differences anytime soon, but things are changing. And the outcome will have an impact on more than the LGBT community. It's a debate about how Russia sees itself, whether it's a conservative nation where so-called family values are prized above all else, or if it's a liberal country where difference is not just tolerated, but embraced. For The World, this is Theo Mertz in Moscow.
Theo reported the story from Moscow for the podcast On Spec. Head down memory lane and revisit some of the stories our correspondents around the world reported in 2021, from China to Colombia to Sudan. They took their microphones and cameras. We collected some of their most striking pictures in a photo essay for you to peruse. Find that on our website, theworld.org. If you are one of the 2.7 million followers on TikTok of food blogger Joanne Lee Molinaro, then you need no introduction to the Korean vegan. She teaches you not only how to cook plant-based Korean food.
Fermented soybean paste. I know. If you're not familiar with it, it can sound a little intimidating. But
you also learn a lot about Joanne's family and her personal views.
Good for you if you're a Korean-American and you never experienced racism and therefore never had to ask yourself what it actually means to be Korean-American.
At the end of that TikTok video, Joanne Lee Molinaro tells her followers to just go eat kimchi. From food blogger to now cookbook author, Joanne's published The Korean Vegan, Reflections and Recipes from Alma's Kitchen. Joanne joins me now from her home in Chicago. Welcome. It is great to meet you.
Well, thank you. I'm so pleased to be here. And I love that last clip that you chose.
Yeah. I mean, it seems that all of this fame on social media really was kind of a happy accident. I mean, you used to be a trial lawyer in Chicago, but then decided to blog about food, but also use that video blog to express some firmly held beliefs. Can you take us down your path to the Korean vegan?
Sure. Well, I actually started my food blog in 2016, which is when I decided to go plant-based. But at that time, it was your typical food blog, just a catalog of recipes, Instagram, Facebook. And in 2020, I started a TikTok account, and it was a happy accident. I did not do so with the intent of creating content. I did it really just to watch other people create content and be entertained or provoked to think about things. But as often happens, I was inspired and I started posting videos of myself creating food. But then, as you noted, instead of taking you through a recipe, I shared my thoughts, I shared stories, I shared kind of my views on the political climate that was going on outside my window, as well as the pandemic.
So I got to say, I go to my H Mart in my neighborhood, and it is impressive, the various cuts of beef and pork and delicate slices or marinating in a fiery gochujang paste. You have not been a lifelong vegan. What was the hardest part about ditching meat?
I grew up eating, like you said, cuts of meat and pork. That used to be my favorite food. So not getting to eat those things was, sure, a little bit hard. But much harder was sort of my grappling with my cultural identity. Who am I if I don't get to eat these things that I associate so much with my Korean-ness? And navigating that path was much harder, but also ultimately far more fulfilling.
Well, a lot of what you do on your TikTok, in your book, The Korean Vegan, is connecting to family. I mean, that is in the title of your book, Alma's Kitchen. Who is Alma and how does cooking for you connect back to family?
Alma means mom or mother in Korean, and cooking with my mother or with recipes from my mother or any of the kind of motherly influences in my life, what it does is it transports me to a place back in my childhood when I was relying on my mother and my aunts and my grandmothers for food. But what it also does is it transports them back to Korea. They live in the United States right now. So it's a transportive, nostalgic, and incredibly intimate experience for me and my mother, as well as the other women in my family.
I mean, I get a sense that it's really absorbing because on your TikTok sometimes you'll be cooking and you don't even talk about the process of the food that you're making. You're talking about family. I mean, your dad in particular, whom you've had an up and down relationship with. Here's a bit from one recent TikTok video you posted.
This is kwabegi. It's a Korean donut. It's also my dad's favorite donut. Y'all are probably wondering, why does Joanne talk about her dad all the time? And it's because my dad is now in his late 70s, and I don't know how much time I have left with him. And I feel like I wasted so much of my life not being the best daughter to him.
Oh, that's so confessional. I mean, both your parents are immigrants from the Korean Peninsula. Tell us about your dad, Joanne, and his story, because it seems to be a driving force in what you cook and why.
It is definitely a driving force in so much of my content because he's a driving force in my life. And so much of my childhood was me viewing him as the typical Korean dad, not affectionate, doesn't talk to me, only views me as a grade, you know, as a report card. How unfortunate is that, that I sort of decided to take that and never really dig for why is he like that? I ultimately discovered a few years ago when I asked my father to share his story with me that his own father had been incredibly abusive with him. And perhaps a lot of the reason he's so withdrawn and aloof from everyone, not just me, is a defense mechanism and a coping mechanism for the pain. And seeing him that way opened this door that I had previously ignored.
Has cooking brought you closer to him?
Absolutely, because he sees how much joy it brings me to feed him. And how wonderful is that? Because when he was raising us as kids, my mom was working full-time as a nurse, he often had to make naengmyeon and jjajangmyeon and ramyeon for us. And now I get to return that favor. And so when I make him naengmyeon or when I make him jjajangmyeon from scratch, which is not something that's easy to do.
And what is that, briefly?
Jjajangmyeon is black soybean noodles and naengmyeon is a cold buckwheat noodle. These are his favorite dishes. And I present them to him. He knows that I'm sitting there waiting for his evaluation, his report card. And that's not only really fun, but it makes us so much closer.
That's the kind of report card you're looking for, aren't you?
Exactly.
So let's talk about the food. I want to ask you about one main course then, a noodle dish that you say you eat at any special occasion, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, whenever you can. Korean glass noodles with julienne vegetables. Is this a family recipe?
Yes. So this is japchae. It's made with sweet potato glass noodles or vermicelli. And it is one of my most popular recipes. And it is absolutely the one dish that I always ask my mom to make for my birthday. Oh, what do you want me to make for your birthday? Japchae. It's like not like there's no hesitation. I ask for it every single year. We often also have it on the Thanksgiving or Christmas table. That's what we celebrate at our family. And as I mentioned in the book, it can be a little labor intensive because you're supposed to saute and stir fry each of the vegetables separately. And so that's why it's a special occasion dish.
And do you have any tips on julienning so many vegetables without shredding your fingers?
You know, practice makes perfect. That's, you know, that's what I tell my husband. My husband is a concert pianist, so he takes, you know, cutting very seriously because he doesn't want to injure his hands or cut his fingers, obviously. And sometimes he'll bust out a fork when chopping up vegetables for his recipes, for the recipes that he makes out of the cookbook or for our meal planner. And I'm like, that's fine, babe. You do what you need to do with the idea that the more he does this, and the more comfortable and confident he gets, I know he'll get faster.
The recipe is for Korean glass noodles. We have a link to it at theworld.org. Joanne Lee Molinaro, thank you very much. Continue making those videos and best of luck with the Korean vegan cookbook.
Thank you so much, Marco.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. You be safe, stay strong, and we'll see you right back here tomorrow.